Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we are speaking with a guest that I am especially keen to have on to interview today, Mr. David Stockman, economic policymaker, politician, financier. Mr. Stockman represented Southern Michigan in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1976 to 1981, later served as the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Reagan administration, and was the youngest cabinet member of the 20th century. Since then, he has held executive positions in many of the most influential banking, buyout, and private equity firms, including the Blackstone Group, Solomon Brothers, and he is the author of a brand new book coming out in April of 2013, The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America, which is a blunt and sometimes delightfully and deservedly scathing examination of the various monetary and policy blunders that have put us in a rather unfortunate position. Welcome, David. It's a real honor to have you with us today.
I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, listen, your book covers a lot of ground, from bubble economics to the end of free markets to where we are likely headed and why. Where the prologue is the credit bubble formed in the early 1980s and carefully nurtured by the Fed, I'd like to begin with the opening act, scene one of the current crisis, which occurred in 2008, by reading this passage from your book. It's in the introduction. And you wrote, "Then, when the Fed's fire hoses started spraying an elephant soup of liquidity injections in every direction, and its balance sheet grew by $1.3 trillion in just 13 weeks compared to $850 billion during its first 94 years, I became convinced that the Fed was flying by the seat of its pants, making it up as it went along. It was evident that its aim was to stop the hissy fit on Wall Street, and that the threat of a Great Depression 2.0 was just a cover story for a panicked spree of money printing that exceeded any other episode in recorded human history." Well, a hissy fit on Wall Street, huh? The current storyline is that these actions actually saved the world and even made money for the taxpayer. Maybe you have a different take on that.
Well, you know, that is the mainstream story, the accepted wisdom. I think it's totally wrong. It's gotten us into huge trouble in terms of a Fed that's out of control. I mean, buying $85 billion of government debt a month, 4 years or more into an alleged recovery, deficits that are still 7% of GDP, which is off the charts compared to anything people thought was plausible even 10 or 20 years ago, when you're several years, again, into an alleged recovery, basically is a measure of how far we've drifted. And I think one of the reasons I wrote this book and have tried to unwind and retrace 80 years of history, going back to the founding of the Fed and the New Deal and, you know, through all the other chapters that we go through, is to counteract this massive, what I call, recency bias, to use Wonk speak, that we are doing things that are so crazy, that are so inconsistent with the accumulated financial wisdom of mankind for centuries and centuries, literally, that we've lost track of how far off the deep end we are. And I think the starting point is the urban legends, the pure mythology about what happened around and about the Lehman bankruptcy on September 15, 2008. We were not on the verge of the Great Depression 2.0. That was Bernanke's utterly erroneous take on it, because he claims to be a scholar of the Great Depression. Frankly, one of the things I take on in the book is that he's not a scholar of the Great Depression. He's a math modeler. And he essentially took Milton Friedman's erroneous interpretation of what the Fed did or didn't do in 1930 and 1931 and pasted that into his monographs, which are, you know, basically statistical noise. So the idea that we were on the verge of a Great Depression 2.0 is utterly wrong. And as a result of that, they flailed about justifying every kind of unusual, extraordinary, and horrendous action, bailing out everybody in sight, that I think is a defining time, a defining moment in our time, because you can't believe anything that is said anymore. And I go through some of these. The AIG was not a contagious, financial disease that was going to take the world economy down. It was a gambling joint at the holding company that could have easily been bankrupted, and the banks who had bought, the so-called credit default swap insurance from AIG could have taken a couple billion-dollar hit each. They were all big global banks, and that would have been the end of the story. Some traders and bank executives would have lost their bonus, but the point I make in the book, everyday Americans on Main Street wouldn't have lost their jobs or their income or their insurance. All of these, insurance subsidiaries of AIG were separate legal entities, most of them regulated, for better or worse, by state insurance commissioners, and therefore subject to fairly stringent capital standards and also restrictions on either asset or cash withdrawal. So the idea that all of these insurance subs were going to be raided for cash and the assets sold in order to pay off the debt of the holding company at AIG, the $100 billion worth or more worth of credit default insurance it had written, is just completely erroneous. One of the many urban legends, and I go on, to cover the rest of them, the money market funds, ATMs going dark, payrolls not met, commercial paper, GE having, crisis of funding. And none of this stuff is true. And I think it needs to be carefully reviewed, because if people realize that the establishment policymakers in the Treasury and the Fed are telling the big lie with a capital B and L, then maybe we can start to understand that we're drifting towards a pretty unfortunate place.
I would agree with that, and I like your use of the word mythology here, because part of the mythology is they talked about AIG's losses, $180 billion, for instance, but somehow it was you had to dig to discover that these were derivative losses and that derivatives are a zero-sum game. So in truth, for every loss, there was a gain. So it wasn't just like AIG lost $180 billion. Somebody made that $180 billion on the other end of that. And what we were really doing was allowing those people who had made those bets with AIG to not have to lose out on their bet through counterparty risk. And so this is really an extraordinary overturning of what free market capitalism is supposed to be like, what rugged individualism, the whole American mythology. And you, in your book, described these bailouts, particularly around AIG and other things like that, maybe GM as well, as a de facto coup d'etat by Wall Street. How did you mean that?
Well, I meant that at that moment in time, such a panic was created in Washington by Paulson, basically. I call him the most dangerous unguided missile ever to rain down on the free market from the third floor of the Treasury. Wrong guy for the job. He had an attention span of 5 minutes. He was emotionally unglued, and I call it the BlackBerry Panic of 2008, because he's running around looking at his BlackBerry, watching the stock price of Goldman drop, the stock price of Morgan Stanley drop, credit default swaps, and other credit instruments tanking, and basically concluded this has to be the end of the world, because he couldn't imagine that a financial system can go through a liquidation and cleanse and clean itself, which is the way financial systems always worked before the 1930s. So that's where it starts, and because of the panic, basically you had Bush clueless sitting in the White House scared to death because he really didn't understand anything. And you had the Congress utterly buffaloed. A lot of these guys wanted to vote no. They thought it was outrageous. The first vote went down. What did they do? They brought him in, told him even greater lies, amped up panic to a level that was shrill and beyond any kind of reasonable presentation, and essentially ran the government, and Bernanke was part of it, because, Bernanke doesn't understand financial market. He's been wrong on everything he's said. Subprime started to raise its ugly head in 05, 06. Never mind, it's contained. Well, it wasn't. 06, 07, never mind, it won't spill over to the rest of the housing market. It did. 07, 08, the housing market is taking a breather, but it'll be okay. Utterly wrong. He has been wrong every call, every turn of the way. In fact, since he went on the Fed in 2002, you know, waving his arms about some terrible deflation that was going to afflict the economy, and so therefore he talked Greenspan into the crazy 1% interest rate and hand over fist government debt buying. So you had two people, I say, who were unglued, who were wrong, out of control, panicked, who spread the panic in Washington. In other words, it wasn't a contagion in the financial system, it was a panic in Washington. And once Washington panicked, then it spilled over onto Wall Street and the rest of the system. But you can hold those two people responsible.
And I think we will. What would have happened, however, if these firms had been allowed to fail? Often it's been said it would have been, you know, what they were echoing at the time, and I still read about it today. People say it would have brought the system down. Do you agree?
I dispute that, and I go through it to the best degree I can. But the fundamental starting point is, I believe that the meltdown was in the vertical canyons of Wall Street only. It was in the so-called investment banks of the moment, starting with Bear Stearns, Lehman, Merrill, Goldman, and Morgan Stanley. It was a run on wholesale funding because these investment banks were recklessly financed. They had built their balance sheet. Goldman was over $1 trillion. Morgan Stanley was over $1 trillion. The others were close except Bear, funded on basically hot overnight money on the liability side and piled up with every kind of odd, good and bad and indifferent asset that Wall Street could assemble and gather during, the bubble times of 06, 07, 08. So when the housing market cratered and the CDOs and other derivative securities that had been securitized out of housing began to fall in value, those were all sitting on the balance sheet of these hedge funds in Wall Street, and they basically were then faced with a run on their overnight funding. You know, they were repoing everything. They had huge amounts of commercial paper outstanding. And when it was clear they were going to take big write-offs on those so-called toxic assets, then the funding began to dry up. And as the funding began to dry up, then the perception that they weren't liquid spread rapidly, and one thing led to another. But the point is, they could have easily gone down in bankruptcy. We didn't need Goldman. We didn't need Morgan Stanley. Regular way bankruptcy would have worked. And out of that, probably 13 new companies would have been formed over the next couple of years out of the remnants of Goldman, because there was a lot of talent there. So, you know, one group would have hung out an M&A shingle, another would have set up a credit trading hedge fund, and another would have gotten into the underwriting business because it doesn't take any capital anyway. So the whole point was, this was not going to spread to the Main Street banks, because the Main Street banks, A, didn't own the toxic assets, and I demonstrate this.
Mm-hmm.
They owned prime quality whole loan mortgages, but not, the securitized CDOs, CDO squared, MBS, and every other variety of that. That was all, manufactured in the meth labs, as I call them, of Wall Street. The idea that we couldn't allow the meltdown to burn out in the canyons of Wall Street is the fundamental point of demarcation. And that's where I draw the line and demonstrate. I go through the banking balance sheet, by the way, of commercial banks in America as of, September 2008. And you can go through the $11 trillion worth of assets they had category by category. And what you will find is they had no toxic CDOs, CDS, etc. to speak of. What they had basically was loans, some of them which would have been bad, but they would have basically been written down and worked out over years. There was no overnight selling panic. And they had persistency of funding. In other words, they had a large deposit base. There wasn't any retail run. And they weren't in the wholesale funding market, in the repo and the unsecured commercial paper market, where the Wall Street hedge funds were.
Well, let's get back to this idea of a de facto takeover then, in essence, by Wall Street, because what I saw was that there was this panic. Billions and billions of dollars came. Allegedly, Goldman Sachs was you know, didn't want the money, but, you know, sort of took it anyway, and et cetera and so forth. And what I noted was in 2009, they were Wall Street banks and bonuses were back to records, profits were back to records. And so where was truly the crisis? I saw an extraordinary amount of money go to Wall Street's direction, and I saw most of that flow out into bonus pools and other things. What really happened there?
Well, I think you're exactly right, because of the essentially there was a cleansing run on the wholesale funding market in the canyons of Wall Street going on. And it would have worked its will just like actually J.P. Morgan allowed it to happen in 1907 when we didn't have the Fed getting in the way. But because they stopped it in its tracks after the AIG bailout and then all the alphabet soup of different lines that the Fed threw out and then the enactment of TARP, the last two investment banks standing were rescued, Goldman and Morgan, and they shouldn't have been. But as a result of being rescued and having the cleansing, liquidation of rotten balance sheets stopped, within a few weeks and certainly months, they were back to the same old game, such that Goldman Sachs got, as you know, $10 billion, and for the fiscal year that started 3 months later after that check went out, which was October 2008, for the fiscal 2009 year, Goldman Sachs generated what I call a $29 billion surplus, $13 billion of net income after tax, and on top of that, $16 billion of salaries and bonuses, 95% of it which was bonuses. So therefore, the idea that they were on death's door doesn't stack up, but even if they had been, it wouldn't make any difference to the health of the financial system. These firms are supposed to come and go. And if people make really bad bets, if they have a $1 trillion balance sheet with $600, $700, $800 billion worth of hot money, short-term funding, then they ought to take, their just rewards, because it would create lessons, it would create discipline, so that all the new firms that were formed out of the remnants of Goldman Sachs, where everybody lost their stock values, which for most of these partners is tens of millions, hundreds of millions, when they reformed a new firm, I doubt whether they would have gone back to the old game. But what happened was the Fed stopped everything in its tracks, kept Goldman Sachs intact, the reckless Goldman Sachs, the reckless Morgan Stanley. Everyone quickly recovered their stock value, and the game continues. This is one of the evils that comes from this kind of deep intervention in the capital and money markets.
Now, this moral hazard, as you're referring to here, how do we get our arms around this? My perception is that, you know, 2008 was a warning shot across the bow. In fact, it glanced off the steel decking. It was that close. And we should have learned something from it. My perception is that there's been a little recovery of the bank balance sheets, courtesy of the Fed, and we have about $100 trillion more in derivatives. The value at risk ratios still are indecipherable to me, but they don't look like they've come down a whole lot. I think the London whale story sort of exemplified that, reinforce this perception I have that the banks didn't learn anything from it, except that if they get in trouble again, they'll be bailed out again. So they're back to, guess what, being as risky as possible, because that's where the money is. Is that a misguided perception? Am I missing something?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, it's a lot worse. The banks quickly worked out of their solvency issues because the Fed basically took it out of the hides of Main Street savers and depositors throughout America. When the Fed panicked, it basically destroyed the free market interest rate, which you cannot have capitalism, you cannot have healthy financial markets without an interest rate, which is the price of money, the price of capital, that can freely measure and reflect risk and true economic prospects. Well, once you basically unplug the pricing mechanism of the capital market and make it entirely an administered rate by the Fed, you are going to cause all kinds of deformations, as I call them, or malinvestments, mm-hmm. as some of the Austrians used to call them, that basically pollute and corrupt the system. So, you know, look at the deposit rate right now. It's 50 basis points maybe or 40 for 6 months. And as a result of that, probably $400 or $500 billion a year is being transferred as a fiscal maneuver by the Fed from savers to the banks. They're collecting the spread. They've then booked the profits. They've rebuilt their net worth. They paid back the TARP basically out of what was thieved from the savers of America. And now they go down and pound the table and whine and pout like J.P. Morgan and the rest of them. You've got to let us do stock buybacks. You've got to let us pay out dividends so we can, ramp our stock and collect our stock option winnings. It is outrageous that the authorities, after the so-called near-death experience of 2008 and this massive fiscal safety net and monetary safety net that was put out there, is allowing them to pay dividends and to go into the market and buy back their stock. They should be under house arrest in the sense that every dime they're making from this artificial yield curve that's being delivered by the Fed out of the hides of savers should be put on their balance sheet to build up retained earnings, to build up a cushion. And I don't care whether it's 15 or 20 or 25% common equity and retained earnings to assets or not. That's what we should be doing if we're going to protect the system from another raid by these people the next time we get a meltdown, which can happen at any time. So you can see why I talk about corruption, why I think crony capitalism is so bad. I mean, the capital standards, the Basel capital standards, they're a joke. And we are just allowing the banks go back into revert to the same old game they were playing before. Everybody said the banks, you know, in late 2007 were, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. The market cap of the 10 largest banks in America, including from Bear Stearns all the way to Citibank and J.P. Morgan and Goldman and so forth, was $1.25 trillion, okay? That was up 30 times from where the predecessors of those institutions had been only in 1987 when Greenspan took over and began the era of bubble finance, slowly at first and then rapidly eventually. And to have the market cap grow 30 times and then on the eve of the great meltdown see the $1.25 trillion of market cap disappear, vanish, vaporize in panic in September 2008, only a few months later, $1 trillion of that market cap disappeared into the abyss of panic and Bear Stearns going down and all the rest. Now, this tells you the system is dramatically unstable. In a healthy financial system, in a free market, capital market, if I can put it that way, you're not going to have stuff going from nowhere to $1.2 trillion and then back to $1 trillion practically at the drop of a hat. That's instability. That is a case of a medicated market that is essentially very dangerous, is one of the many adverse consequences, deformations that result from the central bank dominated corrupt monetary system that has slowly built up ever since Nixon closed the gold window, but really, as I say in my book, going back to 1933 in April when Roosevelt took all the private gold. So we're in a big dead end, a huge trap. They're just digging deeper every time you get a new maneuver.
I want to talk a little bit more about this deformative medication that we're under at this point in time. When I opened the paper up just a week ago and I read about the latest FOMC meeting, and it was a bunch of the same words I've been reading for a while. They're going to continue with $85 billion a month of this stimulative easing. And I have to put this in, look, here's my context for this. If you had dropped me into today from 10 years ago, I would have absolutely freaked out at reading that, because it's a really staggering condition we're under. And this is under, let's set some context here, stocks at all-time highs, junk bonds and other bond funds at all-time highs, not just near, but like all-time ever record highs, and with financial assets pumped up to perfection, as it were, the Fed's still putting $85 billion a month in. What is, in your words, what risk are we running with the Fed pursuing this policy of $85 billion a month of hot money being put into the system?
Well, one, it's sheer lunacy. Secondly, your perception is exactly right, and it points to the enormous debilitating power of the recency bias that exists in the daily, you know, narrative, talking heads in financial media, and all the policymakers who scurry around the process. 20 years ago, there, you know, it would be a raving maniac who would have thought that 4 years into a recovery, the Fed was buying almost all, half of the MBS that's being issued, and a fairly good chunk of the Treasury. So what I think we have to do is not assume the people in charge know what they're doing. In fact, we have to assume that, as Einstein said, when you do the same thing over and over and expect a different result, it's a sign of insanity, okay? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that they've just reflated the same damn bubble. I would point out that the market this week, the S&P, crossed 1566. And so guess what? That is 2%, which is a rounding error in the scheme of things, higher than the S&P 500 was 4,725 days ago. In other words, 13 years ago, we were at the same point, and then we had a massive collapse in dot-com, $5 trillion worth of household stock and mutual funds evaporated, so they pumped the bubble back up again to 2007 and the peak in early 2008. We were back in the 1560 range, and the bubble broke again, and another $7 trillion was ionized. And now they've pumped the bubble back up for the third time, and we've gotten back to where we were 4,700 some days ago. Now, that is a system that is not stable, not functional, not rational, and it's only a question of when this one rolls over, because when it does, you know, the selling panic will be every bit as bad or worse than anything we've had before, because this time not only is stocks and high yield junk bonds and so forth, even commercial real estate is bounded back substantially, but we have this massive bond market bubble underlying the whole thing. And when the bond market rolls over, it'll bring everything down with it.
Junk bonds yielding 5.6%. It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. And so I'm looking at the front page of the Financial Times today, and it was screaming that headline, S&P crosses into record closing high. And I suppose this is meant to signal to all of us, everything's been mended, safe to get back in the pool. I'm particularly intrigued by one of the anecdotes in your book. It's about AutoNation. And the fictional means by which its stock price magically recovered in the aftermath of the Great Crisis, because I think it might serve as some context for this stock run, meaning the degree to which we have inflated stock values, where we see a price that's higher, but the value may not have necessarily increased. Could you walk us through that AutoNation example?
Yeah, well, I can use that one, but let me go to a bigger picture. One of the themes of the book is that we've got the Fed, this kind of central bank dominated market, has created massive financial engineering in three different channels. One, stock buybacks, which have been enormous. Second, leverage buyouts, which are Also huge. And third, constant M&A transactions that end up creating companies that don't work in, you know, 5 or 6 years, then they write it all off and unwind it. And what I'm trying to show is that low interest rates and the huge bias in the tax code for deductible debt as a form of capital rather than equity has created a, you know, almost a giant Ponzi constantly working in the heart of the financial economy. I point out that between 2002 and 2007, the last time, and we could do the same statistics here for this cycle, there was $13 trillion worth of combined stock buybacks, cash M&A deals, and leverage buyouts. And all of that massive cash on the margin was pretty much either borrowed by companies that borrowed money in order to buy back their stock. It was essentially a pay down or a use of their cash for dividends rather than paying down their debt. But the point I'm making is the whole market is working to liquidate the base of stock, to reduce, you know, the shares outstanding in order to create the illusion that earnings per share are going up. And I've gone through company after company to demonstrate that this is really what's going on in the capital market today. And I think it's important because the theoretical reason for capital markets is to raise primary capital for companies that want to grow, want to expand, want to invest in real productive business assets. But we're not raising any new equity net today. In fact, I showed during the Greenspan era, we know what MEW is, mortgage equity withdrawal, which was huge in the household sector. That was $5 trillion. But I show that there was about $3 trillion, $2.5 trillion of what I call Q, C-E-W, capital letters, corporate equity withdrawal.
Huh.
So on a net basis, and it's all in the flow of funds that, you know, that's put out quarterly by the Fed, at least you yep. have that massive, that, you know, from the early 90s to 2008, if you add all the new stock issues, IPOs and secondaries, and you subtract all the buybacks and stock liquidation from takeovers, cash takeovers, whether LBOs or, you know, corporate deals, we basically liquidated $2 to $3 trillion of the equity base. And now why do they do this? Many of the companies I look at, you know, Hewlett-Packard being a great example. I mean, you know, that is a disaster area, and it is a pure victim of this kind of marketplace dynamic. But most of these companies, basically over, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, have bought in 20 to 35% of their stock through constant massive buyback programs. And then if you look at the share count over time, it does not decrease by that much because they then issue, you know, huge wads of new stock options to the CEO. So there's a real game going on here. And I think it's all a deformation that results from the kind of monetary policy we have. In a honest environment where the tax code was indifferent to debt or equity and where free market interest rates were not managed and pegged, I do not believe there's a remote chance that we would see corporations buying back $1 or $2 trillion you know, worth of stock a year. I don't think we would see much of the M&A that goes on, which is really just a financial engineering game that's not creating value added in the economy or in really even gains to shareholders over time. We have some real, as I say, deformations coming out of a badly mangled capital market.
Well, thank you for that context on the stock market. And I agree, people really should look well past the headline numbers of corporate earnings. Even at the macro level, we might note that corporate earnings are sitting at about 11% of GDP, and sustainably they've never been able to hang higher than 6. So there's something going on there, and I think you've given us some insight into at least part of it. There's some gaming going on there, and this deformation caused by ultra-cheap money. Well, we're on our way to $20 trillion in debt. So on the fiscal side of this story and the deformation that happens there, I'd like to, again, just take a small quote from your book. This is the chapter Sundown in America. And you wrote, in fact, what elected officials desperately needed over the last several decades were intervals of double-digit interest rate flare-ups, even rates which reached 20%. High interest rate episodes are the market signal to politicians that vivify the true cost of deficit finance and thereby give them reason to say no to tax cuts and spending increases financed with red ink. So you're articulating what you said is the real evil of the Greenspan-Bernanke regime. What is going on with on the fiscal side as a consequence of all this?
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that there are many evils and many distortions and negative adverse effects that stem from ultra-low, ridiculously low interest rates, zero effectively for the money market short-term funds. But one of them, beyond the financial engineering that we've talked about, one of the biggest is that it's anesthetized all the politicians, because by driving the yield curve to such a rock-bottom level, where you can actually, last time I checked, borrow five-year money at 80 basis points or 90, and you can borrow three-year money in the 40 basis point level, and shorter term for almost nothing, it means that they've run the debt up enormously, but the interest bill gives the deceptive appearance of being manageable and low. But therefore, Bernanke has been the great enabler, and he has contributed beyond measure to the paralysis that we have in the system today. So then they continue to build the debt and thereby increase the exposure, because one way or another, sooner or later, interest rates are going to normalize. In fact, there will probably be, you know, a massive panic in the other direction at some point. And then we're going to be buried in $20 trillion of debt or more, and I think it's going to 30, and we can talk about that, with interest rates rising, and the politicians then will be utterly frozen in fear, because when that happens, the, you know, 1 point on interest on a debt that's over $20 trillion is $200 billion. They can't figure out how to raise taxes and cut spending by $200 billion. On penalty of death if you put them all in a room. So I think we're just painting ourselves into a horrendous corner. And the fiscal equation, therefore, is going to ultimately bring the system down. Now, CBO says, well, let's not worry so much. We're going to have a big rebound in the next 4 years. They got the economy growing 4%. All of a sudden, it hits full employment in 2017. We're at potential GDP, and it stays there forever. And so, therefore, in the next 10 years, we're going to create 17 million jobs. We're going to have a period of, you know, from 2009 to 2023 where there isn't a recession. 14 years without a recession, and, you know, we've had a recession every 50 months since time immemorial. So what I'm saying is the problem is double or triple what's being projected for so-called current law today by CBO. I think the true 10-year out or so, plus or minus, rolling into the early 2020s, is 15 to 20 trillion, and it is so giant, so massive, so embedded that the ability of the democracy to find some political consensus, has already been lost. They can't come up with that much pain. Anything that does make sense, let's say, you know, going on the CPI for Social Security from the current cost of living adjustment to the so-called chain CPI. Well, that's heartburn. I mean, it would cause massive conflict in Washington to do it. it would be easily justified and warranted. But my point is, over 10 years, it would save $200 billion, which I think is about 1% of the size of the problem. So when you see that these difficult issues, closing tax loopholes or any of the rest of it, even cutting the defense budget, create a drop in the bucket effect in terms of the true size of the cavernous gap that's in front of us fiscally, the perception that Washington is paralyzed at present is just a warm-up for how bad it's going to get as the true size of this problem materializes.
Well, this does come to some sort of an end at some point, whether it's through crisis or somehow magically we deal with it all on our own. I think you're articulating my view, which is that, shared by many, which is that we're probably going to skate into a crisis at some point. You've got a chapter called Sundown in America. What does this endgame look like to you? What is this sundown, and how will it be experienced by the average U.S. citizen?
Well, I think economic growth is being ground to a halt. In fact, it already has, even measured on GDP, which I think is overstated because inflation is underreported. But in the last 12 years, which I think you have to look at a trend, I mean, when you have a central bank that is yo-yoing the economy the way it does, don't tell me about last quarter or the revisions to last quarter. Let's look at the trend. Well, it's been 1.7%. Average GDP growth across several cycles since early first quarter of 2000. So interestingly enough, the market got back to where it started and the economy has gone essentially nowhere, because if you look at the internals, you will see that business fixed investment, plant and equipment, it has grown over that 12-year period at 0.8, nothing. Now, you don't have growth in the future if you don't have investment in productive capital today. Even worse, if you look at payroll jobs, we only have 2.5 million more payroll jobs today than we had in early 2000 when the market first hit this week's level. So job growth averaged over that period of time has been 0.1% a year, 17,000 jobs a month, when we have a labor force growing at 150,000 or more a year. So what I'm saying is the economy is already failing, and as we move from a period of the last 12 years where there were tailwinds, I mean, there was a boom in the world economy because Europe, was printing euros, and you see how well that worked. There was a boom in China because it was the greatest construction project and credit bubble in history. The debt here was quadrupled in that period of time, and I do agree that when you borrow money and spend it, it helps the economy in the short run and kills you in the long run. And we had this massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. In the year 2000, when the stock, when the S&P was where it is today, the balance sheet of the Fed was $500 billion. Today it's $3.2 trillion. So what I'm saying is that over that period, everything that could possibly shove and push and pump the economy forward was done, both domestically and internationally, and we got anemic to almost non-existent growth. Now we go ahead in the next 10 years and we got headwinds everywhere. We have a massive debt that the Congress will be struggling with forever. We have a Fed that's already buying $85 billion. How much more can they buy a month, and how much longer can they do it? We have Europe, falling into welfare state old age. We have Japan, heading for the black hole fairly soon. We have China, sooner or later, going to have a massive spill in terms of this enormous banking system and credit bubble that's been created there. So if you look ahead, that's what sundown's about. Nothing's working. Growth is grinding to a halt. The population is getting older. The welfare state is becoming more and more expensive. The fiscal problem will be a crisis every 3 months. And I think it eventually leads to a blow up in the global monetary system, currency wars, as they call them, and an enormous collapse in the bond market. This bond bubble is the most dangerous thing ever imagined by policymakers, And someday, you know, there should be some real reckoning on the part of this group of doves you have on the Fed today, who just blithely keep their foot heavily on the accelerator and think you can buy this debt and buy this debt and buy this debt and get away with it.
Now, this bond market blow-up, when it arrives, it will be truly an extraordinary affair. It'll be global. There won't be many borders you can duck across. And David, I have to tell you, personally, I'm utterly despairing of the idea that voting can or will change anything in this story. Both parties, to me, seem to be completely captured in pursuing exactly the same ends by ever so slightly different means. And if we cannot vote in true alternatives to the status quo, and what we desperately need is changing the status quo, what would you say to somebody like me who holds that point of view?
Well, I would have to say that you're right. The political parties are a disgrace. Both political parties function as a glorified concierge to introduce elected politicians to money and PACs and interest groups and stand for nothing. They will compromise any principle. Look at Obama. He actually wanted to break up the big banks. He should have. It is absolutely imperative. These are wards of the state. They're dangerous, and we need to break them up. But he tried to break them up, and the next thing you knew, all the people around him basically went the other way and nothing happened. The Republican members of the House voted TARP down, and the next thing you knew, they were told to march back up the hill, reverse their vote, trash their principles in order to keep the game going, to try to reflate the bubble. So this is what parties do today, and no policies are going to change. So we have this huge scare of the meltdown and, the end of the world being nigh and the Great Depression 2.0 around the corner. And what have the policymakers done about it? They haven't really done anything. You know, they passed Dodd-Frank, which is a joke. It's an enabling act. It says nothing except it requires 400 studies and massive pages of, Federal Register rulemaking and definitions. It's just tangling up the financial system further in a morass of lawyers, accountants, consultants, and obscurity. So this is what the system does. It produces a Dodd-Frank. It produces an Obama stimulus, which was a Noah's Ark of every kind of misbegotten spending program you could ever think of, and it was basically written by the K Street lobbies, all the way from the Head Start people to the solar, wind, electric vehicle. I have a good section in there on, you got the Obama Green Energy Program providing $1 billion of loans to two billionaires who are trying to develop electric vehicles that sell at $100,000, i.e. toys for the affluent. And this is what was in the Obama stimulus. The system is incoherent. It produces just random thievery, day in and day out from the financial system and, the wards of the Fed who are now out buying their stock and passing out dividends to all of the larceny that occurs day in and day out through the fiscal agencies of Capitol Hill and the Internal Revenue Code.
It certainly does seem chaotic to me, and it seems a little bit like the Wild West, but with maybe more dire consequences. And it seems like one conclusion from this, that the only solution that makes sense to me is to, I don't know if this is too strong a language, but essentially abolish the Fed, or at least revert it to a much more basic functioning. Because if the price of money itself is manipulated, how can anything else possibly work right? It'll obviously have distortions from everything based on that, and that's pretty much everything. So in terms of constructive things that we could offer, What do you have on your plate of things that not only should be done, but maybe could be done to really change things here?
Well, that's a very good question, and I have a chapter at the end of the book on, what could be done but won't be done, okay?
All right.
And item number one is to radically change the Fed, put the Open Market Committee on the bench, mm-hmm. and go back to the original conception of the great Carter Glass, who was the chairman of the House Banking Committee when they created the Fed, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, and the paragon of virtue regarding financial discipline and the gold standard sound finance throughout the 20s, and finally, you know, gave up in old age when Roosevelt went off the deep end. It's interesting, I don't want to get off track, but I think it's interesting to point out that Roosevelt was begging Carter Glass to be a Secretary of the Treasury as late as February 23rd, 1933. The world would have been totally different because FDR didn't have a clue about what he wanted to do. He had no convictions, no principles. He would just try anything. And if he would have had Carter Glass as Secretary of the Treasury rather than, the people he had, the world might have been different. But my point is the original conception was the Fed was to be a banker's bank. In other words, banks that were making commercial loans for inventory or to fund receivables that needed cash because they had depositor withdrawals could come to the Fed, present their collateral at the discount window, have the collateral examined if it was sound. They could borrow from the Fed to manage their deposit balance while keeping their solvent loan customers in business. Now, the key thing about it was Carter Glass, in the original statute, did not allow the Fed to even involve itself in the Treasury market, in the bond market. It was not allowed to own government debt. And that's important because it's the difference in the fundamental, paradigm of a banker's bank which operates a discount window and passively responds to the liquidity needs of the solvent banking sector driven by commerce and industry on a day-to-day, month-to-month basis, and a Fed that's operated through the open market, which heavily buys and sells government securities by its own initiative in order to guide and manage both the financial market and the wider GDP according to the lights of the 12 people who sit on it. It's fundamentally different. That's activist monetary central management. Early on, it wasn't described that way, but decade after decade, mission creep upon mission creep, apotheosis of Greenspan, you end up with a Fed heavily using open market operations to basically centrally manage the U.S. economy and ultimately the world economy. So my point is that if you said the Fed is out of business, there's no more open market operations, they're done, close the FOMC, basically tell the Fed that it can no longer buy government debt, but that it's in the position of liquefying good collateral from real banks, and that's another question. It wouldn't be J.P. Morgan and all the rest of them. It would be narrow banks that make loans and accept deposits. But if you move the Fed back to the Carter Glass mission, where it responds to the economy, the Fed does not then need to know the unemployment rate, the inflation rate. It doesn't need to know the GDP. It doesn't need to know how many container board boxes were shipped last month. It doesn't care about housing starts. It doesn't care about anything in the economic weather report that these knuckleheads who sit on there today report with bated breath in their meeting minutes every time they meet. That's irrelevant. That's noise. Let the private enterprise system and producers and consumers and investors decide through the coordination of the free market what the GDP should be. It's none of the state's business. If it's 2%, fine. If it's negative 1, fine. If it's positive 4, so be it. But when we have a Fed that's in the active open market mode and not the passive accommodation discount window mode, that's the difference between a free economy, a healthy capital market, and the deformed, dislocated, disjointed system that we have today. So that's fundamental. Now, frankly, it'll never happen because there are trillions of dollars worth of financial asset values that depend on the Fed continuing to do the same thing, keeping all the markets above water, pumping liquidity into the dealer network like there's no tomorrow. So they have captured the system. And I don't know how the people of a democracy who are basically victims of all of this, innocent victims, can ever reclaim the one agency of the state, the central bank, which is the most important. The central bank has been appropriated lock, stock, and barrel by the players in the financial system. Now you can say, well, Bernanke isn't on the take. Of course he's not on the take. But intellectually, he is totally on the take because he's afraid that the boys and girls on Wall Street might have another hissy fit. And so therefore, they justify everything, including the insanity of this current bond buying program.
You know what that sounds like? It sounds like a whole lot of common sense to me, and I'm fond of saying that Bernanke's not just running the largest monetary experiment in all of history, but the largest social experiment. These have extraordinary social consequences, and I would just like to point out that I found your book just packed with history and common sense, and the book is The Great Deformation. I invite people to take a look at it. It's really just a wonderful tour of where we are, how we got here, and probably where we're going. So we've been talking with David Stockman. David, thanks so much for your time today and for your new book. I really appreciate it.
Well, great to talk to you.
We've been talking with former budget director, financier, congressman, and current author David Stockman. If you like what you've heard here, I invite you to check out our other great podcasts exploring our current times and what you can and should be doing to prepare for a resilient and prosperous future at our website, peakprosperity.com.